So, all right. Good morning. Hi, I'm Robert McClure from Investigate West. We're here to talk about the Clean Water Act. Thanks for coming. Should have a good discussion here today. We will need to end right at noon, and I'll tell you now, we're going to end right at noon, and when you go downstairs, take your seat right away in order to get served for lunch. Okay, so now we got the housekeeping out of the way. Also, on one other thing, is one of our panelists, Gabriel Eckstein, he's doing a little bit of ballet with plane schedules, and so he's going to be joining us just a bit late. So I think we're going to do is go ahead and start, and then when he gets here, we may be in Q&A by then. We may just let him talk. So, Clean Water Act turned 40 this week, on Thursday. I have the dubious distinction of having covered the Clean Water Act for more than half of the statute's life. And I think the same goes for the gentleman to my right, Mark Schlefstein. He's, the intrepid environment reporter at NOLA.com.
NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune.
The Times-Picayune. And, Mark's a veteran of Clean Water Act coverage. He's going to cover a lot of the basics, sort of what you might want to know as a reporter going into this story, and we can talk more about that in Q&A. A lot of it's covered in the handout as well. And next to him is Dr. Tom Arsufi, who is the director of the Llano River Field Station for Texas Tech University, and he is going to talk about a process that he's conducting in that watershed that probably ought to be done in almost every watershed in the country. And I'll introduce Gabriel when he gets here. So Mark's going to tell us a little bit about his thoughts on how to cover the Clean Water Act.
Okay, so I'm going to give you some sort of brief overview of some of the things that I do or have covered, have been involved in. And let's talk a little bit about what the Clean Water Act has done. And I apologize because I went online to find the most recent national water quality assessment on the EPA site. And the most recent one I found was 2004, which I don't understand, but that's probably just my poor inability to mine the site. But at that point in time, 44% of the 564,000 miles of rivers assessed were still impaired. The mileage of rivers assessed, however, represent only 16% of the nation's 3.5 million miles of rivers and streams. For lakes, 64% of the 16.2 million acres assessed were impaired, while only 39% of the 41.7 million acres had been assessed. For estuaries, i.e., the bottom of the system along the coasts, 30% of 17,721 square miles were impaired, with only 29% of the 87,800 square miles that are estuaries had been assessed. So according to that report, the leading sources of impairment by EPA were pathogens, habitat alterations, organic enrichment, mercury, PCBs, and nutrients. The leading sources of these problems are agriculture, modification of hydrology, atmospheric deposition, municipal discharges, and unknown sources. Okay. So let's talk about some of the pieces of the Clean Water Act that we should be looking at. I live in New Orleans, and I have a wonderful relationship with a major agency in my city called the Army Corps of Engineers. And the Army Corps of Engineers is in charge of regulating 404 permits, which basically tell people whether or not how they can build in areas where there is water. And it basically says, you know, you need a permit to dredge and fill. And to get that permit, which they don't tell you you can't get often, but to get that permit, you have to limit the damage that's done from your action, and you have to mitigate the damage. Sounds great, except the law, like I said, doesn't ban dredge and fill, but it can require mitigation. And the Corps and the states have been repeatedly criticized for not requiring mitigation and not tracking whether mitigation is successful. A couple of years ago, we asked the Corps New Orleans office to basically tell us how much mitigation had they required and how often had they gone out to check whether or not the mitigation was done. And they went, it turned out that the Office of Technology Assessment, I think it was, way back when, I mean, that's
when
a
there
long
was an
time
office
ago,
had
actually done a report that was highly critical of the Army Corps of Engineers for not not checking up on how much of the mitigation was being done. So that's a serious problem. In Louisiana, the Corps issues these permits with the state. So the state has to sign off on and actually does significant parts of this process. They also have to go out there and do these things. The state has actually, ironically for Louisiana, because it is Louisiana, they've actually been ratcheting down the requirements and have been doing a better job of at least requiring mitigation as part of the permit process.
Explain what mitigation is when you fill a wetland.
Okay, so you do a project and it destroys 8 acres of wetlands. You're required to mitigate that loss. Now, that loss, the mitigation does not necessarily have to be all 8 acres. It has to be the value of those acres, and the Corps has a process where it uses average annual habitat units, something that no one understands.
It's a black box.
It's a black hole, basically, to say, okay, your mitigation has to be this many units, and go ahead and bring us plans for building something that will do that within generally the same area. The state has finally reduced their allowed amount of dredging and things like that. You know, they really are putting some major restrictions on it, finally. But it's still a major problem, and there's really nobody keeping decent track of what's going on. And there's nobody really, until now, really, like right now, going back and checking on whether or not a lot of these projects for mitigation are actually being improved. So that's one area that you guys can get into, especially if you're in a coastal area. But anywhere where there are waters of the United States, the Corps generally has authority to deal with that. Okay, so what's the next thing that the Clean Water Act is really hot on? Well, it's permitting point sources, and a point source is a pipe in most cases. The toxics release inventory is a good place to mine for information about what is coming out of those point sources. And when I look in Louisiana, what has caused dramatic reductions in the amount of chemicals that have gone into the water, I see the toxics release inventory as the key driver. Now, TRI is not a requirement of industry to report what they're releasing, but it's not a requirement to reduce what they're releasing. But what we found, we did a series back in 1990, sort of a baseline look at the state of Louisiana. And we went to 17 chemical plants throughout the state, and we asked them, you know, it's 1990, it's 3 years since TRI requirements came out. Now you've got to put this stuff out to the public. Is the public screaming and yelling about the amount of material that you're releasing? And they went, well, no, not really. But you're actually reducing the amounts, right? Yeah, well, why is that? He said, well, because we also had to give these reports to our boardrooms. And the people in the boardrooms would tell us, so explain to me why there's X million pounds of product that you're dumping into the Mississippi River. Stop that. Get rid of it. And so that really has been a major driver of the toxics release inventory. And the other interesting thing about this is that this is the TRI is a perfect example of a rule of the federal government that has required industry to spend a hell of a lot more money in their facilities voluntarily and has created jobs. And the job creation has been in these projects to rebuild their facilities to reduce the amounts of wastes that they are producing. And it's been significant. In Louisiana, just in the 5 years after our series, in that first 8 years after TRI, the chemical industry spent about $5 billion rebuilding their facilities in the state. And it had a significant result on reduction of emissions into the Mississippi River. Okay.
TMDLs.
TMDLs. Total maximum daily loads. How many of you were in Joe Davis's thing immediately prior to that? Okay, so you got a little bit of an initial hit on that. Total maximum daily loads is a requirement of the law that says states and the federal government, EPA, you've got to divide up your water bodies into segments and then determine, based on what those water bodies are used for, drinking water, recreation, primary, secondary recreation, whatever, and then determine what the daily load is that would be the maximum that would allow it to continue to be used that way. And then you have to go back and look at all of the things that are permitted and not permitted within that watershed and determine whether or not you're meeting those requirements. Great idea. Okay. Now, in Louisiana, what happened was, you know, the Clean Water Act was passed in 72. And they didn't get around to doing it until environmental groups filed suit against them, and they are still churning out TMDL numbers for individual stream segments throughout the state. And what we've been watching is that what will happen is the state will start to work on a TMDL area, and then it will, but at the same time, it will be issuing new five-year permits for all the facilities within that area so that they have five-year permits already in place when the new TMDL amounts are announced. So they have 5 years before they're asked to reduce their emissions in those areas. Good stories for you guys to take a look at in your area. The other good part of that is how good a job are the state and EPA doing about reducing emissions in each TMDL stream segment to meet those TMDLs. Okay, so that's a good area to look at. Non-point source pollutants. That's a piece of the TMDL problem. And basically, non-point source are those things that aren't coming out of pipes. That's the easy way of putting it. It's most people look at it as runoff. Agricultural runoff is a big chunk of it. But it can be urban runoff. It can be INI, inflow and infiltration from your sewage treatment facilities within your city.
Leaky pipes,
yeah. Basically, that is getting into the watershed. A variety of different things like that. Again, TMDL is supposed to be the driver for this, and it's not very successful. There's not really a good way of doing it. A major sore thumb in the United States, actually there's two. The biggest one is what's called the dead zone off of the coast of Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi, which is an area of low oxygen on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico that occurs every spring. It's an area that is driven by nutrient pollution. And what happens is that nutrients from the Midwest come down the Mississippi River in the fresh water of the Mississippi River in the spring with the spring floods. The fresh water of the Mississippi River goes on top of the salt water of the Gulf of Mexico. You have a layered system where oxygen in the bottom can't be replenished from the top because of that fresh water. There's actually a heat barrier that reduces the ability of the water to mix until there's a major hurricane or something like that. The fresh water and the nutrients result in explosions of algae blooms. The algae grow dramatically. They die. They sink to the bottom. They decompose and use up all the oxygen. And so at the bottom, what happens is fish avoid these areas if they can. The organisms that live in the bottom, the benthos, they die because there's not enough oxygen for them to deal with. There's real questions about, so who cares? What does it mean? What kind of real damage is it? But there are very serious concerns. So how do you get the states upriver to deal with it? How do you get Iowa to say to their farmers, you can't use so much fertilizer because you're killing fish in the Gulf of Mexico? That's been a serious concern. The EPA has been lambasted by their own inspector general about it. EPA thinks that the best way to do this is through a consortium of states doing it voluntarily. The states tried to do it voluntarily. There's been some action, but it has not been successful. And then you have minor little things like Congress saying, you know, we need a different kind of fuel source other than oil and gas. So we want people to go out and grow corn. And so all these efforts that were made in the 90s to turn marginal farmland back into wetlands that would capture the nutrients, all of a sudden they start farming this stuff again using more nutrients, and no longer are the nutrients captured, and they go off, and we're actually seeing more problems. There's not really a reduction going on. So another good story. Okay. So what kind of resources can you go to find out information about some of these Clean Water Act things? Well, the Government Accountability Office reports, I did a quickie search. There are 3,100 reports in GAO's online database that mention Clean Water Act and 37 that mention TMDLs. A search of the EPA Inspector General's office turns up more than 800 documents mentioning the Clean Water Act and 56 mentioning TMDLs. You can also find Congressional Research Service reports on Clean Water Act-related subjects at the Federation of American Scientists website. As you may know, CRS reports are not automatically released to the public. There is not a CRS website. They're given to members of Congress. They leak out. FAS does a really good job of getting them. And, of course, there's EPA and state websites, which have a variety of information that Joe Davis's session showed us how to get.
Thank you. Thanks. Hey, a couple of quick notes on that. The nutrient problem that Mark is describing in the Gulf of Mexico, it's happening in each and every one of your states and probably in your community, just on a much smaller scale, or sometimes not so much smaller, as in the case of Puget Sound where I work. The other thing is I neglected when I and the other thing I wanted to say was that whole non-point source pollution agriculture, it's the biggest remaining source of pollution, and agriculture was specifically exempted from the Clean Water Act with a few exceptions. So, and the other things, when I introduced Mark, I forgot to introduce him as our chief cat herder, as the SEJ talk list manager. So he deserves a round of applause for that, I think. We're fortunate to have here this morning Tom Arsufi. As I said, he's the field director of the Llano River Field Station for Texas Tech. And I have been watching watershed protection plans be done forever and ever and ever for places that are really screwed up. And he got the bright idea to go out and get a grant from EPA to do it's basically a TMDL, as I understand. I'm going to let him expand. Oh, I see Gabriel's joined us too. We'll get to introducing Gabriel. So he got the bright idea to go do this in a place that wasn't already screwed up, I think is the way. It was my shorthand, Tom. But you take it away.
All right. Thank you.
You might move my mic a little closer.
Let me tell you about my start in water. I was a high school senior in 1969 in Northeast Ohio. And this should be cueing some of you older folks up to what I'm going to relay to you. But in 1970, I went to an infamous university up the road called Kent State University. And there was a river that flowed through the town of Kent. And the name of that river was the Cuyahoga River. And the Cuyahoga River flowed through and into the city of Cleveland and into Lake Erie. And the Cuyahoga River is famous because in 1969 it caught on fire multiple times. Now, 1969 was a few years before the Clean Water Act. lots of our river systems were really, really messed up. So I think, you know, in looking at the 40-year anniversary of the Clean Water Act, you know, is you know, a sort of a rhetorical question as whether or not it was a success. Well, relative to the Cuyahoga River, yes, it's been a huge success. And there are some victories, but there are some challenges. And when I start looking at various environmental issues and problems that we have in the world today, one of the things that comes to my mind has to do with how do we address or solve these problems. And unfortunately, we live or we have a mindset as a society, and it's not just the United States, but it's around the world, that we tend to be reactive instead of proactive. And the Clean Water Act was a reactive piece of legislation. And so largely that Clean Water Act has been relatively unchanged over its 40-year existence. There's been some modifications. There's been some Supreme Court challenges that have weakened aspects of the Clean Water Act, and we can talk about some of those in terms of a remedy. There's going to be challenges associated with the Clean Water Act. Challenges, you know, in academia, you know, because we tend to be researcher-oriented, we look at challenges as research and opportunities. And there are opportunities for investigation. There are also opportunities for reporting. So one of the big issues, and you've heard it repeatedly through this conference, is climate change. Climate change is a huge challenge to the Clean Water Act, especially from the perspective of the one of the things that occurs with climate change is intensity and frequency of floods. Those of you that were in Texas last year, we had the most severe drought, one-year drought in our history. Where I am in the Hill Country, till the end of October, we had a grand total of 3 inches of rain. You know, the Hill Country is populated by cedar trees or juniper, we call them, and cedar were dying right and left, and that's unheard of. Ranchers have been around for years and years, have never seen, they thought nothing could kill a cedar tree. Millions of cedar trees have died. They're dead, mature cedar trees. So we've got a lot of dead cedar trees. We have a lot of fires that have occurred because of last year's drought. So that combination leads to the next rainfall events that occur. We're going to get severe erosional events and sedimentation that are all associated with TMDLs and the Clean Water Act. So I think that's going to be a pattern that's going to be spread around the United States. So that's a consideration to look at and looking at TMDLs and the Clean Water Act. Another issue, and Mark brought this up, and this is one of my pet peeves, or it's an observation. We live in such a complex society nowadays that it used to be, you know, if there was a problem, a single state agency or a single federal agency would be able to solve it. Our problems are so complex nowadays that we have multiple agencies and multiple entities that are getting involved in trying to address the problems. Now, there's been a couple of books written about this, but have you ever heard the term silos applied to institutions? For example, universities are silo-based. There's silos of departments within colleges, and then there are colleges within the university system. And there are bureaucracies inherent in each of those silos that more or less represent barriers for interaction and communication and complex problem solving. And we have that with regard to water. For example, you know, largely, the Clean Water Act is the purview of the Environmental Protection Agency. But there are other multiple agencies that come into play in terms of various aspects of the Clean Water Act. This is interesting, and I looked this up, and this number is not exact, but there's something in the order of 20 to 25 different federal agencies that have some jurisdictional or regulatory capability when it comes to water. The example that Mark was talking about is the Army Corps of Engineers. So when we start having these complex issues in terms of like climate change, the Clean Water Act, rivers, streams, land use patterns, and those kinds of things, we really start needing a coordination, a better effort of coordination among not only federal agencies, but state agencies, as well as local areas, in terms of putting together a cohesive, holistic plan for addressing these water issues. Now, related to that, and I want you to keep the idea of silos in mind, and the idea that I presented earlier in terms of reactive versus proactive. For years, when I talked to EPA, the Hill Country is a really special part of Texas. It's pretty virgin. It's low population. We're talking about 25 counties. Most of the major river systems of Texas start in the Hill Country from springs that come out of the ground, the size most of you are familiar with as mid-sized rivers. They're huge. They're crystal cool, blue, and they're really precious resources. And consequently, when you start looking at water in Texas, those Hill Country springs and rivers form the basis of much of the water planning for the state. So from a proactive perspective, when I talked to EPA, I said, look, you guys focus way too much on water quality. And I said, why don't you have programs that deal with water quantity? Because things that affect water quantity are what concerns most people that live in Hill Country watersheds. So they said, yeah, we understand, we're working on that, we're going to get that. But related to water quality issues, many of you have heard this little saying, it's one of these sayings, in relating water quantity and water quality, dilution is the solution to pollution. Okay, and so there is a strong linkage between water quantity and water quality. So finally, a couple of years ago, we were doing some projects on the Llano River and engagement and outreach with the landowners, and we helped, along with some others, develop a local watershed alliance of regional ranchers, stakeholders, and others to protect the Llano River. Now, the Llano River is one of those pristine spring-fed river systems. There's not a whole lot of water quality problems, not historically. It's not in a very populated area. We've got some hog problems. We've got some overpopulation of white-tailed deer. We've got some exotic deer problems. And there's a few invasive plant species that have sprung up along the river that are really, really huge issues someplace else. But all in all, it's a healthy watershed. So we wrote a proposal under this brand new healthy watershed initiative that EPA has to develop a watershed protection plan. And this is what's interesting, is that the basis for this is that ecologists, I can remember early on in my career and going on, giving talks about, things that I worked on. And ecologists are pretty good in talking about our science and the value of biodiversity and nutrient cycling and how these things relate to these kinds of things and, a scientific kind of a thing. But for most people, the take-home message, you're a tree hugger. But there's a whole lot more to ecology than being necessarily a tree hugger. And some of the things that I worked on were invasive species. And I went I gave a lot of public talks dealing with invasive species and their impact on endangered species. And I gave a talk in this one location, and I was talking about, the science of invasive species and the science of biodiversity and the value of preserving endangered species and the classic canary in the, the coal mine kind of thing. And I got the question and answer period, and this guy in the front row raises his hand, and he says, endangered species, yeah, find a stick of dynamite and throw it in the river and blow them up and solve all our problems. What good are they? And that was his question to me. And so I was.
How articulate.
And so I gave, you know, some of the standard types of things, real quick. And I said, this is not going to work. And it dawned on me. I said, well, without that endangered species in your river, your town would have nothing but a dry ditch flowing through it. And most of the businesses and economies upon which this community depends would go elsewhere. And the guy stopped, and the guy next to him poked him in the ribs, and he said, I guess he told you. And that's when it first dawned on me that for some people that these species, these ecologies, there's economic arguments to make. So I started doing economic analyses associated with invasive species and water and those kinds of things. The point I'm making is that's what EPA has done. A classic landmark paper that I think really revolutionized ecology was in 1997 by a guy named Robert Costanza. And what he did was write a paper in which he monetized the value of ecosystem services. And ecosystem services has to be, you know, from an environmental reporter perspective, is a gold mine of stories.
Hey, Tom, I'm going to interrupt you here because you got about 2 minutes left, and I want you to tell us about your $1.1 million grant and what you're going to do with it.
I will.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to continue with ecosystem services. So the basis of EPA and the Healthy Watersheds was they've done the cost-benefit analysis. It's far cheaper to keep a watershed and a river and healthy and intact than to repair it. And I think the cost ratio is like 5 to 1. You know, if you let a water body go impaired, it's going to cost 5 times as much than it is to keep it healthy. So I think the pattern and the program is the proactive, is forming community groups. The spatial scale at which you do that is at the watershed level. And at the watershed level, that's where it makes the most sense because all the water runs downhill and it either ends up in the lake or in the river system and the community. And so by being proactive, then you put together a plan where you identify the threats, you identify the problems, you identify the solutions, the best management practices, you put in a chapter on the cost and implementation strategies. And then once you have that plan, then you can start looking for funding to solve whatever issues, minor issues, you may have at the head start before they become a huge problem.
Thank you. And that's what I thought was really special here, is that people are looking at a watershed before it gets screwed up and coming up with ways to keep it from getting there. Our next speaker is Gabriel Eckstein. He is at Texas Wesleyan University. He used to be here at Texas Tech. And he was part of a fascinating report called Alternative Strategies for Managing Pharmaceutical and Personal Care Products and Water Resources. I think we've heard about PCCPs. This guy and his colleagues have looked into it very carefully and tried to figure out, well, how do you regulate this? And they've come to some pretty interesting conclusions. One of the things they looked at is the Clean Water Act. They looked at some other statutes. Gabriel, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I appreciate this opportunity. Focus here is supposed to be on the Clean Water Act, and I think I do want to at least mention the fact that, I mean, the Clean Water Act has seen some successes, and I have to admit to a Kent connection. I think we've talked about this, but I grew up partly in Kent, in Ohio, on the Cuyahoga River throughout the 80s. I went to Kent State. And so, aside from the whole National Guard incident in 1970, one of the other big stories was the fact that the Cuyahoga River did catch on fire, and it wasn't the first or second or third time it had caught on fire since, I think, the late 1940s or 1950s, numerous times. And so this whole notion of trying to come up with strategies to clean up our waters is a very important one. And the Clean Water Act has had some major successes. Now, I'm not a champion, a diehard champion of the Clean Water Act, because it has some major problems, some serious problems. And in fact, in my opinion, it is, in today's world, quite outdated and outmoded. Let's face it, the Clean Water Act is a mechanism that gives permits to pollute. That's what it does. It gives you permits. If you can get a permit, you're getting a permission to pollute, to put pollutants into the river. And we did this back in the 60s and 70s because we were trying to figure out, well, where's the pollution coming from? And at least the ones that we can somewhat control, the big factories, the ones with the pipes that were coming into the rivers. And eventually we learned that today, you know, maybe as much as 60%, 70% of pollution entering our waters comes from what's called non-point sources, which I think Mark mentioned. So trying to regulate pollution in our freshwater systems through a mechanism that really only addresses some 30% of the pollution is a very challenging strategy and somewhat outmoded. And it is particularly outmoded with something that we're now calling emerging pollutants. And I think it's a quaint and somewhat strange name, emerging pollutants, that if they just emerged out of nowhere. although I've also heard it about
it's
pollutants of emerging concern, which that might make more sense because we weren't quite clear about them previously. And this is where PPCPs, pharmaceuticals and personal care products, really come out front and center. All journalists here. Do you remember 2008, early 2008, the AP put out a series of stories. They did a 4-5-6-month investigation on PPCPs in our drinking water. Okay, not just in the freshwater, in our drinking water. This stuff, the stuff you get at your tap at home. And their investigation found widespread evidence of contamination with both over-the-counter and prescription drugs, including painkillers like ibuprofen, acetaminophen, codeine, hormones like estrogen, statins for reducing cholesterol, antibiotics, anticonvulsants, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, tranquilizers, in what you're getting at home at your tap. What's in the rivers right now? And they found that somewhere maybe 40, 50 million people's drinking water was contaminated to some degree. Now, granted, the studies showed that the quantities of each of these individual contaminants was relatively small. I mean, pretty tiny. But the problems that we've sort of learned is that we haven't quite figured out it's a small amount, but what happens when you're exposed to it over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years? We don't know. What about when you have this little tiny substance combined with this tiny substance and you have the synergistic effects, and we don't know those consequences? Now, the studies have been relatively conclusive that aquatic species and those critters and plants that are in the water 24/7 do suffer adverse effects. Everything from deformities, feminization of species, all sorts of other maladies have really been documented relatively well. The studies have not been very conclusive about human health, although there are some pretty worrying trends in those studies. We just don't have studies about people drinking this water for 30 years, chronic exposure studies. But that's something that's being worked on right now. Literally overnight, I believe it's the first or the second AP story came out, Congress was up in arms. They started scheduling congressional hearings. They started having meetings. And this was by the mid-2008. And then they went on recess for their summer break. And then they came back, and we had that election thing. and then, has anybody seen any articles since? We also had that economic issue come up. So it got sort of swept aside. And it is one of the issues that I'm still kind of startled a little bit by the fact that it got swept so far aside as a story. It was a major headline story. And granted, the economy is a big issue. The election was a big issue. But it hasn't come back at all. Occasionally, you still see some stories here and there. But we were able to get a grant when I was here at Texas Tech through EPA to do a study on a couple different aspects of it. One was to try to collect all these studies that somehow tended towards having a policy or legal conclusion. We didn't want to get too bogged down in the science, although we did look at the science of it. And so we developed a clearinghouse of information. I think we collected something like 2,500 documents and reports. And if you go to micropollutants.org, micropollutants.org, it's all up there, searchable, accessible to the extent that we didn't have a copyright issue. At least it'll get you to where you can find the document and pay for it or something like that. Unfortunately, we haven't followed up and gotten an update grant, so I think it only goes to about early 2011, maybe 2010, 2011, as far as documentation. That was one part of the study. Second part of the study was to look at what's coming out of Lubbock's wastewater system. And if you think about it, the concerns were of these contaminated waters were really the downstream folks, because where is this stuff coming from? Well, yeah, we do have our hospitals who are disposing of drugs and unused medicines in bulk, and we do have healthcare facilities that are doing the same, and we do have improper disposal. I'm sure some of you have flushed unused medication down the toilet, because that's what we were told to do. But in fact, and I don't have the numbers because I'm not sure if we really know the numbers, but the research we found is that the majority of the sources of pharmaceuticals and personal care products is every single one of you. It's the stuff that doesn't metabolize. You're taking your medicine and it doesn't metabolize completely and it goes through the sewer system. It's the And everybody forgets the PCP, the pharmaceuticals and personal care products. So it's the fragrances, it's the soaps, it's the detergents, it's the dual-use products like all the sprays, lotions and stuff. It's the insect repellents and so on. You get in the shower and you wash it off, and it's going into the sewer system. And our water treatment systems, the fresh water, the stuff that comes into your home for drinking and bathing and so on, it doesn't get treated out there, and it doesn't get treated out at the wastewater side, which is, you know, it goes through the sewer system and it's supposed to get treated before it gets back put into the rivers and lakes and so on. It doesn't get treated there, not because we're just ignoring it. It's because it has not been a priority, and because the technology, although we have the technology, it's really expensive. Reverse osmosis is probably one of the best technologies we have to get rid of the stuff, but to try to put that at every wastewater treatment and freshwater treatment system in the country would be just pretty much prohibitively expensive.
Not to mention the energy implications of that.
Build new coal plants.
Let's not get into the climate change implications absolutely. So we haven't done this. It hasn't been a priority. We do not have. We've never set standards of how much acetaminophen is acceptable in your drinking water. How much heart medication or whatever other product is acceptable. This is something that hasn't been done by EPA or anybody else. And so, and by the way, this is another one which another couple of sources, the confined animal feeding operations, veterinary uses, all those, I mean, they're using tons of hormones and medications for the animals. And the other one, which I think is which again, we don't have the numbers of percentages, but dead bodies. 2.5 million people, I think, die in the U.S. every year. I don't know, a large percentage of them are buried.
Ew.
We decompose. You know, we decompose eventually over time. And there have been studies in the vicinity of cemeteries that have shown that the presence of certain pharmaceuticals are higher in the water, in the soils, in those vicinities. I mentioned we did this. So we did the study in the Lubbock area, seeing what's coming out of the Lubbock water system, and we did find certain pharmaceuticals and personal care products that are being deposited in the waters or in the outflow of the waters after treatment coming out of Lubbock. And then the third part of the study that we did was, we looked at the regulations, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, TSCA, Toxic Substance Control Act. We looked at common law options, like tort law and strict liability and some other things. And our conclusion was that this stuff was never set up to deal with what we call micropollutants. These are really tiny pollutants. And the fact that there are as many as 6 million pharmaceutical and personal care, pharmaceutical and personal care product substances out there. If we try to do this under a regulatory system, just think about it, because our system is set up in terms of technology fixes. Well, the technology to get acetaminophen out of the water or out of this contaminated soil is going to be a little bit different than to get some of the pesticides that we're using in bug sprays or to get the fragrances out. And even if we can condense these 6 million substances into some groups, we're still talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of groups, meaning thousands of different technologies that would have to be implemented on the same facility, treatment facility. Again, cost, energy, and so on. So in terms of our study, I only brought a handful here. If anybody wants it, I've got a copy, and I can mail you. I have a box in my office of others. But our solution, if it's a solution, is you can't do it when it's already in the water. You got to do it before it gets to the water. So proper disposal is the obvious one. But even further, excuse the term, upstream, everything from product manufacture. Can you manufacture the product in a way that reduces those particular substances? How about product delivery? We don't do a very good job in differentiating between a medicine that goes for an adult versus a child. Well, we do for those two, but what about an adult who's only 5 foot, 100 pounds or 90 pounds? What about an adult who's 280 pounds and 6 foot five? The doses are not regulated very well, and we don't tailor our medicine to the body size and their ability to metabolize. We also have automatic refills in this country. And when we have these take-back programs, they're not very often, once a year, twice a year. But I read about these take-back programs. There's one up here in Amarillo they did with the police, and it was great. And they publicized it. And, it's West Texas. So a guy drives up in his 4x4 truck, F-250 or something, and comes up and lifts the flap off the back, and it is completely full. His parents were an automatic refill on their medicines and just never paid attention to it, and they passed away, and he came to their house and tried to,
He could have set up a pharmacy.
Sort through the stuff, and he didn't know what to do with it. Luckily, they had this take-back program, and he brought, complete flat truck full.
We should leave it there.
Yeah.
Because we definitely want to get to the audience for questions.
Sure.
I will mention some people came in late. We had a handout. They're all gone. If you want to come up and see me afterwards, I have some that aren't printed out very well and aren't stapled together, but you can have those. Or you can give me my card, and I'll send them to you. There are more about the nuts and bolts of CWA. So the first question, somebody cleverly left it here. Please deal with thermal pollution from power plants. Is that person still in the room? I think she may have left. So we're going to move on. What else do we have in terms of questions out here? Yeah, Bobby. I'm going to repeat the questions for the recording. The question is strategies for public lands and ecosystem services, and I take it that's going to Tom.
Yes. Yeah. The economists are really getting innovative with regard to their valuation techniques and being able to put price tags on different types of ecosystem services. And they've got four characteristics now of ecosystem services: the provisioning, regulatory, cultural, and cultural means, you know, sort of like recreation, aesthetics, spiritual, you know, those kinds of things, and then supporting. Those are four aspects, and so what they do is go through and put for particular ecosystems, they go through evaluation system for those four characteristics of ecosystem services. And let me give you an example. You know, wetlands are a real popular topic just because, you know, in the last 100 years, we've lost 50 to 70% of the wetlands in the United States. And so wetlands, well, okay, why did we lose wetlands? Well, part of it was because people wanted to develop. And they put a condominium on a wetland. So how do you put a value on a wetland? Well, typically, you know, if you're a real estate agent, it's just the price of that land. But when you're dealing with an ecosystem services, you have multiple economic benefits associated with that wetland. You can estimate a cost in terms of flood control. You can estimate a cost in terms of filtration. One example of an economic strategy is replacement cost. So sometimes wetlands do a lot of things that wastewater treatment plants do. So what would it cost to put in a million-gallon wastewater treatment plant? That's what that value of the wetlands. In terms of tourism, you know, down in South Texas, birding, ecotourism associated with birding is a larger economic generator than the citrus industry.
That's interesting.
And so there's that economic value of a wetland. Hunting, fishing. Fishing, this is a statistic that's just astounding. There are 30 million fishermen in the United States. They equate to 1 million jobs and $45 billion in economic generation. So those are the ways that you go about looking at the multiple benefits of an ecosystem relative to a single use like a condominium or some other source.
Okay, let's hold it there. More questions? Yeah, in the back.
Find an environmental issue that you're interested in. And there are papers out now where you can actually, you know, you could find an ecosystem service valuation associated with that. For example, I just gave you one on fishing. They have the same. The Sportsman's Fund has a big giant thing on ecotourism, recreation, hunting, fishing, and they break it down by states. And that's just one example. So there's stuff out there. Just find the ecosystem and the issue you want to focus on. And you can weave in ecosystem services as part of the story.
Part of the one other way of doing that is look at how, the agency is that is issuing 404 permits in your area, and determining what way they are identifying how much things cost, and use that as a way of jumping into a discussion about the system that they're using. A lot of the districts have moved to what's called the modified Charleston method, which is a new way of valuing wetlands that does use some of the things that Costanza was talking about. The Army Corps of Engineers has run into significant problems with dealing with that because there's been huge blowback in communities because the modified Charleston method requires like a 4-to-1 increase in the amount of mitigation. So it's pretty hot.
Okay, boy, a lot of questions. Yes, down, Kieran. Say who you are, too.
Hi, guys, from Northeast Ohio. I'm Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist from the Republic of Cuyahoga. You're right, we can't do that to farmers and so on.
Okay, so the question's about untraditional journalistic treatments of the nutrient pollution regulation question. Who should we be going to?
So one way of looking at that is addressing it as a business story, looking at the fertilizer industry and determining whether or not there are companies out there that are selling their services as much as their product. In other words, hey, we are going to be basically your consultants on how to deliver the material to your fields in the smallest amounts possible. There's all sorts of GIS-based systems now, tractors, you know, these hugely expensive tractors where they know exactly where they are in the field and how much you know, tiny amounts of nutrients are being done. That's my suggestion.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. In back. The question is about whether, if there's work being done on how ecosystem services can replace sewage treatment and similar technological fixes, right? Okay.
Yes. I would point everybody on the EPA website. There's a paper. They've got the economic benefits of protecting healthy watersheds. And one of the examples that gets a lot of press is in New York. New York City has spent, what was it, $1.5 billion, and I don't remember the amount of acreage, but they bought something like 10,000 acres of forested land in the upper watershed. And because they did that, it's going to save them $10 billion of building a water filtration plant. So I think that's an example of the types of things that your question was addressing or asking.
Let me give you another example. In Louisiana, there is a major coastal restoration project that is beginning now. The first step of it is $10 million. The effluent from two sewage treatment plants in the New Orleans area is being put back into a too salty area of what used to be a cypress forest and now is open water, as part of a longer plan to rebuild that area and return the cypress forest. The combination of the fresh water and the nutrients in the effluent will be used to spur the growth in that area. But again, it's a two-edged sword because of this guy over here. We don't know what it's going to do to the critters that are in there. So that's going to be something that's going to have to be looked at as we move forward with all these things. But there are a number of those kinds of projects that are on the ground and actually being run in Louisiana and or are in the process. And that's going on nationwide.
Okay, we have less than 15 minutes. Do we have any questions about personal care products and pharmaceuticals?
Yeah.
Nope. Folks, that's where it's going.
There's one.
Yeah,
there's
right
one.
Back there.
Carolyn.
Okay, the comment is that in California, the water treatment authorities are actually getting quite concerned and going to manufacturers of these pharmaceuticals and personal care products to get their attention. Whap them. Going to the state to whap them upside the head. Okay. Okay, over here. Yeah, the question is, what could be done to control non-point source pollution and what legal framework and in that context, would it be a good idea to open up the Clean Water Act for amendment, given the current political situation? Anybody want to take that?
it's a tough issue in terms of what can be done. Non-point sources in the U.S. we have a legal notion of causation. We want to show that person over there, his activity caused this problem over here. So when you see a pipe delivering pollution into a river, it's fairly easy to make that kind of connection. Oh, we've got extra nutrients or extra pollutants of this sort, and that pipe's delivering it. When it's something that's just kind of flowing over the land, diffused source, and there's maybe dozens, if not hundreds, of farms or other homes, those kinds of things. Who do you point to as being responsible? Now, there are notions of strict liability, too, which might help that by saying, well, anybody that operates a farm because of strict liability, you're going to be responsible for sharing some of the burden, whether it's through a tax that addresses pollution or some kind of limited use per acreage of certain substances. I don't know. I mean, it's a tough issue, and I can tell you the Europeans are struggling with this. The Asians are struggling with this. This is not unique to the United States.
I can add something very quickly. Right, and that's common that municipalities are. I will, real quick story about Washington. Washington does have a legal framework, which, unlike most other states, says that when you do a TMDL, ag is on the hook legally to do this. And there's a case right now going to the state Supreme Court, a farmer named Joe Lemire, who let his cows just poop all over the stream, and eventually the state ecology department said, okay, well, we're going to enforce on you. And he said, no, you're not. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in that case. Because if the state wins, then the very legal framework that you're asking about, Ilsa, will at least have been established in Washington. And if not, then we'll be back to the tough situation that Gabriel described.
And in the Mississippi River watershed, there's a consortium of environmental groups who have filed suit against EPA to basically say, you have got to take primacy away from the states, on this issue. And you have got to regulate under your laws the way it should be instead of this garbage about, cooperation and consortiums of states and doing things like that. Because you're not following the law. The law is clear. It says you've got to get it out of the water and you're not doing it.
Okay, Rona.
Jump in. There's one great big hole that was exposed in the Clean Water Act. And I don't remember the exact years, but the Supreme Court, there was two Supreme Court challenges, and they won, and they weakened significantly the Clean Water Act. And when it was originally drafted, the Clean Water Act had a term in there, basically protect the integrity of the nation's waters. But they put an adjective in there that screwed everything up, and that adjective was navigable.
Yeah, this is the Rapanos case, and the that's the Rapanos. Okay, let's move on. Rona. Good. The question is about how exemptions got into the Clean Water Act for industry, and particularly for agriculture. Anyone want to take that, or I have some idea how that happened. There was a huge fight. You go back and look at the legislative history. Basically, Congress saw that if they were going to go to ag, they weren't going to get the Clean Water Act passed. And I mean, ostensibly, the reason was that, well, agriculture and, by the way, forestry, logging are so different from place to place and from state to state that we should really leave that to the states. But when you actually analyze it politically, it was because they knew if they did that, the farm state legislators wouldn't go for it and it wouldn't have passed. And by the way, President Nixon did not sign the Clean Water Act. It was passed over his veto by more than two-thirds. It's a common mistake. Don't make it.
Let me just add, the other piece of your question had to do with oil and gas, and what happened there was very similar at the very early stages of the Clean Water Act. They were basically, oil and gas industry was exempted for waste from oil and gas production. And, of course, there's produced water that and that includes lots of toxic materials because it's in the materials that are put down well to get the thing going and all this sort of stuff. And this stuff would be taken and put into pits, and they didn't have to follow the same laws. And that's one of the real problems that continues to this day, and that's one of the things that's a problem with the fracking.
But let me, if I may, because this touches on the navigability issue, because for fracking, when you're producing this dirty water, you're not taking it back into navigable rivers and streams. And that's why the Clean Water Act is not well implicated in fracking operations. The big exemption there is from the Safe Drinking Water Act and some of these other statutes. The frackers are actually taking that dirty water and injecting it, and so the Clean Water Act is not an issue because navigability, the navigable waters, is actually something that I don't know if the federal government can avoid, because federal authority, it has to either come through the Commerce Clause or some other avenue where they can actually have authority on something that's happening exclusively within a jurisdiction, within a state. And if it's navigable waters, then that gives the federal government the authority. So if we took out that word navigability, we would have a fight in terms of whether the activity that is happening within a state can be regulated under federal law. And so that navigability, yes, it screwed up the whole system now in terms of how we're trying to interpret it, but I'm not sure we can really get away with it. It's an issue of interpretation, and Congress was supposed to have reinterpreted it recently, and they haven't done it.
Okay, we're getting pretty low. You've had a question, your hand up for quite a while back there. Question is if the municipalities aren't going to use RO to clean the personal care products and pharmaceuticals out, should we be doing it at our homes?
Look, if you have kids, I mean, you're going to do anything possible to keep them away from any kind of pollutants. I mean, my wife is probably one of those fanatical, you know, clean persons around. You know, we have filters for drinking water on our house. We have, you know, at the tap for filters for heavy metals and so on. I just saw an advertisement from one of the refrigerator makers saying that their water, you know, they have a filter in there and they're using charcoal, activated charcoal, and they claim that it will remove 95% of pharmaceuticals. Now, my only question, and I couldn't ask them, it's an ad, is it all PPCPs? We're talking, you know, all the millions of PPCPs. Well, they're highlighting in their studies only the 5, 6, 10 most concerning, the ones that we know of that are of particular concern. Let me just point out, a few years ago, I think 2010, as part of the outfall of this AP series of stories, EPA did identify 287 pharmaceuticals that they were considering putting on a watch list under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the contaminated watch list, and they ended up not putting any of them on there except one, nitroglycerin, the heart medicine, which also happens to be that stuff for explosions and for blowing things up. That's the only one that is being considered on the draft for this watch list. So there is about 287 substances that are on a high alert level. They still haven't made it through the EPA process.
Okay,
so if it's me, I would do it.
That list of 287, EPA has passed a rule this year that requires a number of municipal systems throughout the United States to monitor for those chemicals and report back as part of a continuing process to deal with
the
rules.
But there's no standards.
Okay. We can get in one last question. Tell us who you are. Yes, the question is whether, since ag is exempted from the Clean Water Act, is that fault of the state to regulate it? And the answer is yes, it is. And usually, though, what happens is when they do these TMDLs, basically they can't make ag do what they want. And so many of those cleanup plans are not working. What laws are farmers under? In terms of water pollution, not a lot unless the state's taken action. What's that? Well, there are some exceptions, right? Confined animal feeding operations. Although, when you look at the way that gets done, it's really interesting because they regulate the manure when it's on the farm, but once the manure leaves the confines of the farm to get spread out on these fields all around it, it's no longer regulated because that's not going on a CAFO. So, anyway, so there are a few exemptions for ag, but generally, and CAFOs are the big one, but it's got a sort of an exemption to the exemption, so. Okay, folks, I think that's all we have time. I know you have a lot of – we'll be up here if you want to talk more.